couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The Call of the Wild, Brahms the Boy 2, The Lodge, Standing Up, Falling Down, and The Night Clerk. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the 2019 revival of The Twilight Zone. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Normally, as you know, when it comes to news, I don't talk politics. I mean, my God, if you want to talk politics, right or left, you got a billion places to go, either on the dial, on the radio, or on the internet somewhere. But every now and then, politics and movies collide. And we had a moment of that happening the other night at a rally. President Trump went off on a tear about Parasite winning Best Picture at the Academy Awards. I found it just an odd aside, and that's not uncommon with the president and his rallies. He'll go off on diversions and go off on tangents and wander around. That's sort of his thing. That's how he publicly speaks. That's what's gotten him in trouble before, when he's trying to give a regular statement as a president and he ad-libs. And generally, you should just stick to the script. But he was talking about why did the Academy give the Best Picture to Parasite, and then he laments the fact that, like, Gone with the Wind is it? Well, first of all, Gone with the Wind had its time, for crying out loud, people. That thing's over 80 years old. That came out in 1939. There have been so many other movies since Gone with the Wind, and if you're still clinging to Gone with the Wind, you're a dinosaur. It seemed like there was frustration that South Korea won what at least the president seemed to think as an American contest. And true, the Academy is housed in America. Its members are mostly in America, and it's for Hollywood. But the reality is Hollywood is multinational at this point. You can't go to a major movie without seeing some co-financing with an international company. I mean, for years, it's been German companies have used tax shelters and that sort of thing. Recently, you see a lot of these Chinese companies and Asian companies investing partially. And you'll see movies that are made for an international audience. We've talked about this before, like a movie like Warcraft, which flopped in America, did extremely well in the Middle Kingdom. And of course, they made a sequel that never even got released in America. So this concept that the Academy Awards are strictly an American thing, that's untrue. It's a Hollywood thing. And if you're going to say the Best Picture of the year, it should be open up to international cinema. Now, the reality is most people don't see all the international movies. But every now and then, there's a movie that rises to the top and gets some sort of notice, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was a Chinese production. And so even though I was not a fan of Parasite winning, I'm not a huge fan of that movie. I think good for them. You know, they won, and that's great. And if the Academy thinks that was in fact the best movie of the year, then give them the award. But this lashing out at Parasite or the Academy for not being jingoistic about their movies. I mean, this most likely 1917 would have won if Parasite hadn't. That thing's partly British co-financed. That's not a 100% American movie. What's wrong with that? Would that have been bad? There's also a lot of Korean Americans in America who can take pride in the fact that a Korean won Best Director. Also, my other question is, does the president notice how many times a Mexican has won the Best Director? I mean, Iñárritu, Del Toro, Cuarón. I mean, there's a lot of international people who have won Best Director. So why not a South Korean? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer is one that this kind of dovetails out of the news section. And that's because it's reared its head again in a slightly different way. And that is The Hunt is back on the schedule for March 13th.
What is happening? What is all of this?
Did you see that article? Every year, these liberal elites kidnap a bunch of normal folks like us and hunt us for sport.
It wasn't real. We were joking.
There's been a killing spree. You gotta come here right now.
You actually believed we were hunting human beings for sport. But you are.
If you recall, The Hunt was this movie where these liberal elites kidnap and then hunt for sport what had been described in the trailer as deplorables. It was clearly drawing some political lines there. It happened to be ready to be released right after a mass shooting, and that left a bad taste in people's mouth. Now, this is not the first time release schedules have been bumped around due to elements in a movie causing problems or being too close or cutting too close to the bone for real life things. I mean, you had, for one great example, there's Gangster Squad famously had a scene reshot and re-edited because they had a shooting in a movie theater right around the time of the Aurora shooting. So it's not uncommon to have these movies move around. I think it was the Watch. That was that comedy with Ben Stiller and Vince Vaughn, Richard Iowati and Jonah Hill. And they were a neighborhood watch. And I think that got bumped because of the Trayvon Martin case. So this happens now and then. So what they did, I found fascinating about The Hunt is they've brought it back to be in theaters. But if you listen to the trailer, they changed things up a bit. They've changed it to make it sound like they're playing with perception. They're playing with propaganda. They're playing with news. They're playing with what people say versus what they do. And it actually makes me interested to see this movie because I'm like, oh, this might be a little bit higher thought process than just, oh, this one political group is going to hunt this other political group. It looks like it's playing with sort of an analogy of how politics works and how divisive politics works and how it's spun into the media. So I actually am very interested to see this because it's not just, you know, left against right or right against left. It looks like it's trying to dissect the issue. And I find that actually more intelligent, which I'm not surprised because the director is not known for just making crap. Anyways, the next one I want to talk about really quickly is The French Dispatch, which opens on July 24th.
It began as a holiday. Eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, Arthur Howitzer Jr. transformed the series of travelogue columns into The French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, and diverse stories of human interest.
You don't think it's almost too seedy this time?
No, I don't.
For decent people.
It's supposed to be charming.
I may butt heads with film nerds all the time at different things. You know, there are certain things where I'm like, Christopher Nolan can do wrong. He is not the above anything. I mean, I think he has some issues with him. There are some directors who I turn my nose up. I think they're artsy fartsy. And I can still love unabashedly some crap that's out there like the Star Wars prequels. But the one thing where I'm all in as a film nerd is Wes Anderson. I love Wes Anderson's movies. I think they're brilliant and exquisitely directed and constructed. And this is going to be a new one. You don't get much of a sense of story from this, but you get a real sense of it feeling like a Wes Anderson movie. And it's funny. I was watching the trailer. My wife sat in the room and she goes, "Is that a Wes Anderson movie?" And I was stunned that she knew. She said it reminded her of The Royal Tenenbaums, one of my favorite movies. And she looked up the director and said, was that the same director? So, you know, kudos to my wife and also kudos to Wes Anderson being that auteur that even my wife, who doesn't notice the names of directors, will zero in on that if given the chance. But yes, I'm very much looking forward to this. I always look forward to a Wes Anderson movie. And I'm looking forward to him doing a live action movie again. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Standing Up, Falling Down and Brahms the Boy 2.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Standing Up, Falling Down. After returning home to Long Island with his tail between his legs, a would-be stand-up comedian finds an unlikely surrogate father friendship with his dermatologist.
I'm making a comeback. 7 p.m. I'll be there.
Go and find yourself a real job, okay? You're telling jokes for pocket change. You're better than that.
Let me tell you something about life. Everybody moves at their own speed.
Scott, what happened to us?
I got scared. And when I get scared, I run away.
Lightning rarely strikes twice, but if you keep your eyes open, it can strike again.
What does that even mean?
Listen,
the guys I like the best are the guys who are real. The real guys are the ones that you remember.
This film stars Billy Crystal as the dermatologist. He's an older alcoholic who has estranged children, but he's a dermatologist during the day, and he's usually sober during the day, and then in the evening he hangs out in bars and he smokes pot, he gets drunk and gets into trouble and what have you, and he's kind of a little bit of a pariah in the bar he hangs out with, and he swerves into this guy played by Ben Schwartz. Now, if you don't know who Ben Schwartz is, he's actually blowing up in the movies right now because he's the voice of Sonic in the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. But if you don't know what he looks like, he is most famous for playing Jean-Ralphio Saperstein in Parks and Recreation. He's the metrosexual, trendy, overly hip and annoying best friend of Tom Haverford, played by Aziz Ansari. And I've always found Jean-Ralphio is one of my favorite characters on Parks and Rec because he's so absurd and he's such an idiot. And he is so bad at trying to be just a normal human being. And I get a kick out of his stuff all the time. But now that Ben Schwartz is done with Parks and Rec and he's trying to expand out and do other things. And this is a movie where he plays this stand-up comedian who's trying to get his life back together. Now, the thing with a movie like this, I have seen this movie a dozen times. Not this particular one, but this type of film. It is not uncommon to find a movie that is about somebody attempting to make his dream happen or her dream happen and failing and having to come home or return back home for whatever reason. Maybe the parents are sick. Maybe they've run out of money. Maybe their career's not taking off. They come home and they have to deal with that failure in their life. The fact that they aren't the big hit that they thought they would be. And everybody runs into that, even the people that are famous. Well, maybe if you get famous when you're like 15, you know, the Britney Spears of the world, it's a little different for them because she was a star before she was even going through puberty, you know, in the Mickey Mouse Club. But most people, even famous people, go through just garbage years and they struggle. And one of the things, there was a movie called Comedian. It starred Jerry Seinfeld and it followed him around after the end of the Seinfeld television show. And it showed him building new material and trying it. And they have this great bit in the movie where it shows him just dying in a club. His material's not working. His jokes aren't landing. Nobody's laughing. And he is just dying on stage. And you never get to see that. And I gave a lot of credit to Seinfeld for letting that be out there to show that even though he's Jerry Seinfeld, one of the most recognizable comedians on the planet at the time, you know, sometimes this stuff's not funny. I once watched George Carlin on Conan, and I watched him just die with this bit he was doing, and it just wasn't funny at all. And what that reminds you is that even the people that are top of their game, who are the best of the best, fail. And there's a reality to that. So, I mean, we've seen a lot of these movies where you have that person have to come back and they deal with an old relationship and they deal with having problems with their parents and the, you know, trying to find a job. So a lot of this is similar territory. And we've also seen the thing about the alcoholic father who is estranged from his kids. One of the things that works in this movie is it's just very charming. It's very warm. Both Ben Schwartz and Billy Crystal, they have great chemistry and it's a warm chemistry. They're not abrasive to each other. They're, even if they're struggling, you kind of feel for them. You feel sorry for them. And there's somebody you feel that you can hang out with. One of the things that happens with stand-up comedians, if you've ever known one, they're very depressing people, by and large, as a group. They're very depressing. They're self-deprecating. And it can be really heavy to hang out with a stand-up comedian. And while Schwartz's character does fit that description of being self-deprecating and, you know, putting on, and that's used often as a defense mechanism, he's not undesirable. He's still a nice guy. You can see yourself going out and having a beer with him. And of course, his character butts heads with his father. And so he finds a father figure in the Billy Crystal, and Billy Crystal, his character is, estranged from his kids. And so he finds a sort of a surrogate son, and they have a really sweet relationship and they support each other. One of the things it does not do is you don't have the big Oscar moments. You don't have the scene where he goes home and he goes to his dad and they have a big fight and they start screaming and yelling at each other. And you don't have the scene where Billy Crystal tries to see his kids and gets in a big screaming match with them. There is that scene where he's trying to reconcile thing, but instead of him just screaming and yelling and doing the overacting thing, what's more powerful is to watch him dying inside while he's trying to smile and crumbling and falling apart while he's still being rejected by his kids. And that's the real power. That's where the real good acting comes in. Anybody can get mad and start yelling, but to show that in your face is very different. And the other thing, you don't have him come home and like throw everything around and knock everything off a desk, rip a sink out of the wall. We don't have any of those scenes because those scenes, those are big. Those are too easy to do. Those are actors wanting to overdo it rather than doing something very realistic and powerful. And that's what makes this movie work. I really enjoyed this movie, and I found that it had an awful lot of heart and an awful lot of reality in it. So I'm going to have to say that Standing Up, Falling Down totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Brahms, The Boy 2. Now, if you don't remember The Boy, it came out a couple years ago, and it was about this family that got a nanny for this doll that appeared to be human. So, of course, we have a sequel, which is another version of that. A young woman becomes a nanny to a doll, which appears that it might be real.
I understand that some of Jude's behaviors would be upsetting, but I urge you to find a place where he feels safe. I think it will be good for him. Good for all of us.
Oh my goodness, look at that. That must be the main house. Come on, Jude.
It looks like he was broken before and put back together.
Who's this handsome chap?
Brahms.
How'd you come up with that?
He tells me all sorts of things.
This was not screened for me, so I didn't get a chance to see it. I remember liking most of The Boy. I wasn't wild about the ending, partly because I didn't think it was a great ending, but also partly because it did kind of steal the ending from a New Zealand movie that I'd seen a little bit before that, and I felt that that was a little bit of a cheap shot. I don't know whether they meant to steal it. They may have just come up with similar ideas. This one looks like they're definitely going for a supernatural angle, but who knows? Looks like it might be a little bit spooky, but it's PG-13. And this feels like just another soldier in the parade of PG-13 horror movies that have been coming out in 2020. So I'm not holding my breath for much greatness with this movie. But they didn't screen it, so it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Call of the Wild and The Lodge. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with The Call of the Wild. A man forges a friendship with a dog during the Klondike Gold Rush.
I came up here because I didn't want to be around anyone. And then I met Buck. He was a dog like no other. He'd been spoiled.
Out! Come on, Buck!
And he'd suffered.
Come on!
Could not be broken.
This is based on the classic Jack London novel that came out right around the turn of the century, early part of the 20th century. And this is a very popular book. Jack London was this and White Fang. Those are the two big Jack London books. It focuses on the dog's point of view. It's told from the dog's point of view. Starts out of dog of privilege. He's like the dog of a judge, and he ends up getting dognapped or kidnapped, and sold as a work dog going up towards the mining towns in the Yukon Territory. And it's all during the Klondike Gold Rush. And he spent some time as a sled dog, delivering mail and having adventures that way. And then he finds this prospector and they end up kind of becoming an unlikely pair and going off and exploring even more. As best as I can tell, for the most part, they get all the beats of the story. The biggest difference is that there's some stuff at the end that is sanitized, we'll say. What happens in the book is actually, I went back and I looked it up. What happens in the book is incredibly politically incorrect. And it's also not something that's needlessly being stripped from the book, because it is politically incorrect. It's inflammatory and it is a little bit racist. Now, it's something that would have shown up in a book in the early part of the 20th century, but not exactly going to land well if you're making a movie today. So they do change some things up a little bit in the movie, but the essence and the core and the heart of the story is there, and the heart of what ends up becoming of this dog and his relationship with the wild itself, that's all still intact. And I mean, it's a beautiful looking film, although here's the thing. And I'm going to go ahead and start talking about the stuff that bothers me. This is directed by the guy who did Lilo and Stitch, which was his first directing gig, which was through Disney. It's an animated film. And he also did some other movies like How to Train Your Dragon and The Croods, which are both computer-generated movies. So the guy is familiar with working with computers to tell a story. And even with Lilo and Stitch, which was a cel animated film, he's used to directing animated stuff. There's a ton of computer-generated stuff in this movie. The backgrounds. Let's start with the backgrounds. It doesn't look like a lot of places they've actually shot too much on location. Now, I'm sure at some point they sent second unit up into British Columbia or the Yukon Territory or even Alaska and got some footage to look, because like part of it takes place in Skagway, Alaska. Now, I've actually been to Skagway, and I think they capture the look of Skagway quite good. I mean, obviously, I went to Skagway in, 2017, and this thing takes place at the turn of the 20th century. But Skagway, Alaska, it looks authentic, but I don't know if it looks completely photographed. I think there's a lot of digital backgrounds. There's even like a scene where Harrison Ford and the dog go to the edge of this precipice and they're looking out, and it's this just gorgeous landscape with trees and the sunlight and this valley. But I don't think there's a hint of that that's real. I think that's all just computer generated. And that's a problem, because we have these things you can actually go see. You can photograph this stuff. And I understand if you're making a movie like How to Train Your Dragon, where you're going to have backgrounds and development and that sort of thing, but you can put Harrison Ford on a cliff and have him look out there. Additionally, all the animals in this movie, or most of the animals, are computer generated, in particular the dog. I mean, the dog, there's not even a regular hero dog that they photograph. It is, as best as I can tell, it's computer generated from beginning to end. And not just that dog, but every other sled dog in the story, all the elks and the deer and the mule deer that he sees and the bears and the wolves and the birds and all that seems to be computer generated. And that bothers me. It's off-putting to me because, you know, if you're making a movie like The Avengers, there aren't any giant green rage monsters running around to photograph for those films. So you have to computer generate the Hulk. But we have dogs. We have access to dogs. Dogs are all over the place. There's more dogs. Unfortunately, there's more dogs in the world than people even want. And we've been using dogs in films for decades, 100 years. And you compare this to something like The Bear or Homeward Bound or Old Yeller or any of these Incredible Journey type movies that shot dogs in the film, you ask yourself, why aren't they using a real dog? I mean, for obviously for the stunts, and there's like a scene where he stares down a bear. Fine, use some special effects for that, because that can be dangerous. But there's a lot of stuff where you just have a real dog. It's takes me out of the film so much to have the CGI character, and they use motion capture to give it expressions and that sort of thing. And I understand if you use that for like Planet of the Apes, because the apes have a real nuance there. But this one, they just shouldn't have used it. To paraphrase Jeff Goldblum from the Jurassic Park movies, you were so concerned on whether you could, you didn't think about whether you should. Just take a regular dog. And I know that's the thing that took me out of the movie the most. Otherwise, it's a very charming adaptation of it, but this is a huge mark against it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks, but it could have been so much better with real animals.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Lodge really quickly. Two children whose mother has died are stranded in a house during a snowstorm with their father's new girlfriend.
I don't want to leave you here with the kids if you're not feeling up to it.
I'm feeling fine. It was my idea and it took a couple days. I can do a couple days.
Things are very uncomfortable between us and we're stuck in a house together.
What is this?
The power's out.
Where are my things? It makes no sense.
What?
I heard something.
This is a horror movie, and it's certainly being pushed as a horror movie. And it's not that it's not a horror movie. I wouldn't want somebody to approach this movie the way you did with They Come at Night, which was being billed as a really grisly horror movie, and it really wasn't. It promised something different with the trailers than you got. And I feel that the trailer for this is a little misleading, and that's unfortunate. There are some good performances here. Riley Keough, who's of course Elvis's granddaughter, she plays the woman, and you have real sympathy for her because the father and the mother have separated, and the father is a psychologist who worked with this woman who was stuck in a cult, and then he started to have a relationship with her. And when the mother commits suicide, he's stuck with the kids, but then he also wants, he's going to get married to this woman, and so he wants them to have a relationship, but of course they resent her. So not only do you have just the, you're trying to replace our mother, it's the, you're trying to replace our mother and she's dead, and they blame her, and so there's a real tenuous relationship between her and the kids, even though she's really, really trying. And I think that there's some interesting things it does. The problem is the resolution's not great. It's not a great ending. And unfortunately, for a movie like this, the ending's the most important thing. Once you commit to what's going to happen at the ending, you can affect the quality of what comes before it. And that's the thing that I had the biggest problem with, is the ending wasn't as strong as it could have been because I don't think it chose the best ending. While it's a good performance, while it has good cinematography and good acting and some great setup and visuals, It just doesn't have the punch of an ending that I really wanted. Anyways, I'm going to have to say that The Lodge still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Night Clerk, The Box Office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Twilight Zone. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show with another review, and that is of The Night Clerk. A young man with Asperger's witnesses a murder in a hotel where he works nights.
You're new here, right?
Yes, I work the night shift. My name is Bart.
Well, it's very nice meeting you, Bart.
I have to practice what to say. I watch people, and I imitate.
You watch people?
Well, I study them.
Yeah, well, I guess you have a lot of people to watch at the hotel.
Yes, I do.
We have a dead woman here, and I think Bart knows something about that.
What's interesting about this movie is it has okay setup. it uses the fact that the character has Asperger's in a way that I've always kind of frowned upon in movies. I'm fine with having somebody with Asperger's or autism in a movie. I think that's good. I think we need to have a certain degree of representation of characters. What I don't like is I don't like when they put the person with Asperger's or autism or somebody on the spectrum, that becomes the crutch to make the movie interesting. If you take that element out of the movie and you don't have a very compelling film, that's where I think it fails. I don't think that people with Asperger's should be reduced in these movies, because a lot of times you see them as like, well, they're a genius and they're super good at math, but they're this special thing and they witness a murder, but it's hard to communicate with them. Or there's an alien presence that connects with them. Sometimes it's thrown in there almost dismissively. Now, in this one, they kind of really make the character, because of his Asperger's thing, they make him really off-putting, because what he does is he works in this hotel and he wires up all these rooms with hidden cameras, but he doesn't do it for like some sexual predilection. He does it because he's watching people in private and how they talk and interact, so he can mimic them, because he doesn't understand the emotion and the human interaction that he has. And they never really point that out until you're finally about halfway through the movie and you're like, oh yeah, he's not doing it because he's getting off on it. He's doing it to basically study the human condition, but it almost asks you to excuse it. I don't know. It's weird. I don't think the treatment of Asperger's and autism is properly done in this movie. The other thing that is the problem with this movie is, while it has some interesting twists and turns in the whodunit, there's only like about six characters. So if you have a big surprise in it or a reveal, or you're hiding the identity of somebody, doing this with only like six characters makes it really easy to guess what's going to happen. The movie could have been more complex. It could have been written better. It's almost like there are these five or six characters in a snow globe and they really don't interact with anybody else besides themselves. There's some decent performances. I actually think it's got a decent cast. Helen Hunt shows up as his mother. Ty Sheridan, of course, plays the main character. Most people recognize him for movies like Mud, or he was in Ready Player One. He played the main character in that. He played Wade Watts. You got John Leguizamo as the police detective who's got a drinking problem, who smokes too much, and then sits at home pondering his cases instead of just living a regular life. And then you've got Ana de Armas, who made a huge splash in Knives Out just this last year. But she plays a questionably helpful character. But like I said, it needs to be more people in this movie. It either needs to be done as this very tense suspense drama with just one or two people playing chess with each other, or it needs to have more characters to hide what's actually going on. It kind of tries to do both and it doesn't quite work. It has some decent elements, but I wasn't thrilled with the movie in the overall sense, because I thought it was a little bit too simplistic. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, it was a huge win for Sonic the Hedgehog. No one expecting. I think that the estimate going into the weekend was going to be like 40 million. It made 60 million, which I believe is the highest grossing video game movie opening ever. A little piece of note is, and I remember this from last year when Tomb Raider came out. The original Tomb Raider with Angelina Jolie 20 years ago, up until now, has held that spot as the highest grossing video game adaptation opening weekend. Well, now Sonic has beaten that $58 million, which is fantastic. I think it's great that the studio listened to the fans, and I think it's good that they made a movie that the fans could relate to, and they changed the design of Sonic to look better. But it is one of those things where you look at it and go, you should have done it right the first time. You shouldn't have had to respond to a backlash. You should have made the character of Sonic look proper from the beginning. Birds of Prey, or Harley Quinn Birds of Prey, is not doing great, although it's doing better internationally. It's doing almost, like 40% better than it is domestically, internationally. So it might break even when all said and done, when you get through all of the run, but you know, it's still not a huge hit. Fantasy Island came in with 12.5 million, and then The Photograph with just over 12 million. Other than that, no big surprises except for Downhill, which apparently got like a D. The Cinema Score reflects that at number 10 with less than $5 million in the box office. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is actually going to be on The Twilight Zone, which has been available on CBS All Access for a while, but now you can get it on DVD and Blu-ray for yourself. You don't have to pay the monthly fee for the CBS All Access, and that is the new Twilight Zone, hosted by Jordan Peele.
When the world is trying to tell you something, it will repeat itself until you get it.
I told you what would happen.
This is a matter of national security.
This is real, and I have evidence to prove what's going on here.
I don't expect you to believe me. I just need you to help me end it. End it. End it.
Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
I talked about the first episode when it came out, because they released that, I think, for anybody to watch on YouTube. But I had a chance to go through and finally watch all the other episodes of this Twilight Zone run. And I have to say, I'm a little bit disappointed. I don't think the writing is quite there. Now, I think they are doing the social commentary that you got from the original Rod Serling show. Stuff like Replay deals with Black Motors getting shot. You've got A Traveler, which is the fourth episode, dealing with xenophobia. You've got The Wunderkind, which is about a campaign of getting a child elected president, which shows commentary on our political system. You know, they've got a whole series of ones that have messages to them. They're just not as well written. Some of them are just a little bit obtuse. Some of them don't hide their stuff as well. There's a whole episode of one that's about toxic masculinity. It's called Not All Men. But it's so heavy-handed in its approach that it's not even trying to it's trying to deal with this, but it's trying to deal with toxic masculinity in our culture and rape culture and abuse. But it's so heavy-handed in it doesn't allow any subtlety. And that's not to say that the Twilight Zone episodes didn't get in your face back in the 60s, because they certainly did. There's plenty of Twilight Zone episodes where you just kind of have to roll your eyes and go, yeah, I know this is supposed to represent that. But there are other Twilight Zone episodes that do hide it pretty well. Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, I think, is a great episode to show paranoia. And while it's pretty clear that that's what they're doing, it's still a compelling episode. And these new Twilight Zone episodes don't quite they don't quite cut the mustard in terms of telling a cohesive story all the time. It was a little disappointing. When they finally get to the end, there's an episode at the end called Blurry Man, which is the final episode of the season. And I think that that's really kind of cool. Because it gets very self-referential, and it's aware that it's a Twilight Zone episode, and they do some neat things with it, but there's really only two or three episodes in this that I really felt were decent, and even then, the decent ones weren't fantastic. So, unfortunately, even though it's kind of cool, I'm going to give it a kind of rocks. I hope that the second season of this is a little bit better.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week on DVD and Blu-ray, we've got Jojo Rabbit, 21 Bridges, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Midway, and The Good Liar. And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Invisible Man and The Ride. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.